Hello, and welcome to the second edition of the BRC's new trade policy podcast. My name is William Madison. In this edition, we'll be discussing the latest developments in the UK-EU negotiations and the implementation of the protocol on Ireland and Northern Ireland, both of which have come centre stage again this week. I'll be joined once again by the BRC's other William, our trade policy expert, Mr. Bain. Hi, William.
Hello there.
And we're also joined by Aidan Connolly, the director of the Northern Ireland Retail Consortium. Hi, Aidan.
Hello there.
And together we'll be exploring what's new in trade and what it means to you. So starting off with you, William, Brexit and the UK-EU future relationship negotiations have been back in sharp focus this week, like they never went away, really. What do the two letters from Michel Barnier and David Frost tell us about the prospects of an agreement by the end of the year?
Well, certainly it doesn't appear to be a sort of billet-doux, you know, showing eternal love between the UK and the EU. But neither should we sort of take that it's panic stations quite yet. I mean, there are quite serious problems in terms of both sides' positions being far apart, with not too much time left in this negotiation, all to be concluded by the end of the year. On sort of key issues like the level playing field. Now, this was the agenda which the EU began to develop around about 2018. One could see it in the sort of the internal slide presentations going on in the Commission. And the idea runs like this. You know, the UK is the fifth or sixth, depending on which day we analyse the GDP data, largest economies in the world. The EU is one of the world's three massive trading blocs. There are huge links in terms of supply and labour data economically between the EU and the UK, much closer links than, for example, between the EU and Canada. And therefore, as a result, to try and get the kind of agreement which the EU would like and the UK would like, zero tariff, and with a reduction on non-tariff barriers compared with other trade agreements, the EU developed this idea about the level playing field and said that in certain areas, such as state aid law, competition law, the UK should be in lockstep with the EU. And in other areas, there would be something called non-regression clauses applying. So these would set a baseline on things like environmental law, social standards, labour rights, workplace and production effectively, which the UK would not fall below, nor indeed the EU. And that really is the heart of the level playing field agenda. Now, in last autumn, things like climate change, respect for the Paris Agreement were added to that. I think increasingly in these negotiations, the EU is adding human rights protection to those as well. And the UK government's position is that this is an incursion in the UK's newly rediscovered sovereignty. And it is unacceptable. It is not being asked of by the EU in any of its previous trade agreements. The UK says that its offer is based on precedent. All of the things it's looking for are based on things which the EU has agreed with other countries before. And so it's not asking for something unreasonable or novel. And therefore, there should only be the sort of level of provisions on employment rights and labour rights and the environment that are typical in some of the EU's past FTAs. What the EU says, by contrast, is, well, look, we are looking for, we've never done a zero tariff deal with any other third country before. You know, the UK is looking for things like mutual recognition on professional qualifications, such as legal qualifications. These would be quite novel. So we do need to have these strong provisions to make sure that one side doesn't unfairly undercut the other in terms of regulation. So I think we have a real impasse on that, not an irresolvable one. It's possible to see a landing spot later in the year that both sides would agree. But for the moment, there's an impasse. Also on fisheries, there has been an impasse. So the EU has wanted to base its offer on historical quotas and the position really before the UK left the EU. The UK, as an independent coastal state, wants to have a different process, much like those which Iceland and the Faroe Islands and Norway have with the EU. Again, it's possible to see where the movement's going to come on that. So I don't think those are going to be fatal to the talks. Again, on the governance of the agreement, the EU would prefer a sort of overarching mechanism to resolve disputes, potentially also involving fines on the UK. This would be a unilateral process. The UK wouldn't be able to fine the EU for non-compliance of the agreement. The UK would prefer much more compartmentalised enforcement mechanisms, arbitration, namely, for each of the areas of cooperation. Now, again, it's a big difference, but it's not irresolvable. So I think that would be my overall sense that, you know, we're not at crisis point yet with a lot of goodwill and hard work and compromise, a deal can be reached by October. But I think the critical point for businesses, if something is reached in October, there would be only 2 months to prepare. And so the issue about having some period to allow businesses to adjust to new trading terms is, I think, going to come to the fore.
So this week, we've also seen the UK has produced its draft negotiating legal text. What's in that that's of significance to retailers?
Well, it's really interesting. We've now got sort of two bumper legal texts from both sides. They're not complete because some of the elements are very sensitive and would require further negotiation. So, for example, on food legislation, the sanitary and phytosanitary controls, as we always term them, the technical term, then really there isn't any text from the EU at all on that. And the text from the UK in terms of the extent of controls on products of animal origin entering the EU or presumably entering the UK in terms of GB are not in the UK text either. But what it does provide is a sort of direction of travel. So we can see that, for example, the UK is asking for a deal on conformity assessment, certification, testing of electrical and industrial products, things like fridges, hair dryers, washing machines, which is quite extensive. It would offer a great deal of flexibility for retailers and reduce the amount of red tape and being able to market a good manufactured in one market on the other market. We can also see that the UK is looking for some reasonably extensive labour mobility, particularly for professionals. On qualifications, it's going quite far, looking for a mutual recognition agreement. So there are some things in the text which, yes, are based on precedent, whether it's the Canada-EU trade agreement or some of the other agreements the EU's reached with other countries, for example, on organic foods with Chile. But there is a lot which goes way beyond those templates, if you like. And so the argument that this is just a sort of photocopy of the Canada trade agreement or a sort of greatest hits of the EU's previous trade agreements is not entirely accurate. There are things here which would be really novel for the EU to give in terms of a trade agreement. Now, there are many things in the UK text that I think retailers would want to support. So, you know, having the maximum cooperation on customs, on SPS, on certification and testing of these industrial and electrical goods, these are all good things. I think the issue is that it's really possible to see finding landing spots on a lot of this stuff, as long as we get the bigger blockages in the process that we described earlier resolved by October.
Mm. So the UK government has also produced its list of applied tariffs in the event that there is not a deal to cover the portion of the UK's trade not covered by trade agreements or unilateral preferences with developing countries, those sorts of things. Are there any surprises from the new UK global tariffs?
Well, of course, what we're going to think about is, last year the UK produced a temporary tariff regime, the TTR, as it was called. And this was meant to come into play if there was a no deal, whether it was in October or some of the other deadlines, of course, last year for a no deal Brexit. And this schedule is, of course, a very different thing. It is the applied tariffs, the actual tariffs to be applied. In respect of that part of UK trade which is not covered by rolled over trade agreements, for example, with countries like Switzerland or Norway or South Korea. Although, of course, the UK's rollover trade continuity process has not been completed. There are still quite a few which have not been done. For example, Canada would be amongst the biggest of those. And so these tariffs would just apply to goods which are not covered by a trade agreement or the UK's unilateral trade preferences. That's the what we call the GSP, the General System of Preferences, the other two schemes as well, GSP Plus and EBA, everything but the arms. So that's largely trade with the developing world. And of course, in the Tory manifesto last December, it set the ambition of having, I think, 80% of the UK's trade covered by preferential agreements, either unilateral or bilateral trade agreements with other countries. So this is intended, if all goes well in terms of the EU negotiation, just to apply to about a fifth of the UK's trade. But nevertheless, it's a significant fifth. It's very different from the TTR. So if you look at the number of product lines, there's about 11,500 on the schedule. So 4,500 of those are unchanged at zero, compared with the temporary tariff regime, the no deal tariffs. About 3,700 have been increased by over 5%. So there are some changes there. 2,000 have been increased by between 0% and 5%. Some have been decreased by a small amount, very few though. So in terms of decreases, it's about 55 out of 11,000 product lines. We've got some new tariffs on 900 product lines and some adjustments for currency valuations. So what this means is that in comparison with the no deal tariffs, which zero rated or reduced rated 88% of product lines, there will be tariffs. If there was a no deal scenario, for example, between the UK and the EU, if we were importing goods from the European Union, they would, a lot of the stuff that was zero rated last year in terms of the temporary tariff regime is subject to quite extensive tariffs under the schedule. And so I think in terms of food, things like citrus products, you will see a big difference. Higher tariffs here compared with the zero rating under the TTR. But if we compare this schedule with the EU's tariff, the tariff which the UK is still applying during the transition period to its non-preferential trade, there's not really a huge amount of difference. I mean, the average tariff on every single product line falls from 2.1% under the EU's MFN to 1.5% under this new UK global tariff schedule. And what you see when you compare the two is maybe some small reductions, 0.5% here, 1% there. So it's not going to make a huge difference. We're not going to see massive changes in consumer prices. And what I think it also does is it shows that the UK wants to preserve its negotiating leverage for other trade negotiations by not giving away big cuts in tariffs unilaterally or indeed zero rating things unilaterally in a way which might diminish its leverage in the future. So it's a much more nuanced schedule than existed last year. But it's very important to reinforce this point. This is only intended to apply to that portion of UK trade which is not covered by the GSP, the developing world trade, and which is not covered by a preferential trade agreement. So it will not apply to, for example, imports of pasta sauces or chocolates from Switzerland, to give you just one example.
So in short, what do this week's developments mean for retailers trying to navigate the changing landscape and prepare for January or whenever it may be? Does it look likely that there'll be an extension to the transition period now, or is that possibility sort of diminished?
Well, I think there's going to be a twin track approach for retailers in that prudently they will have to prepare as if there was going to be no agreement or a very thin agreement coming into force on January the 1st. So effectively to prepare for leaving the customs union, the single market, the common VAT area with a hard deadline of January the 1st. But it may well be the case that an agreement comes which does provide much more attractive trading terms. But in terms of being prudent and preparing for the worst case eventuality, preparations are going to be necessary. Now, what we've been doing is to make the case to the UK government that it needs to start producing preparedness notices for what to do at the expiry of the transition period. We're confident that in the next few weeks that will come to fruition and we'll start to have a series of things which the UK government is asking UK-based companies to do. Well, I'd also point to the preparedness notices which the Commission has been issuing to EU companies in terms of what to do there. And they also have some really interesting material on what to do in relation to Northern Ireland. So I think that message has gotten through to the UK government, and we will see some preparedness material that is much needed and much asked for by retailers over the coming weeks. On the question of extension, you know, there are many business organisations and businesses who've been calling specifically for the kind of extension that's prescribed within the withdrawal agreement, i.e. an extension up to 1 year or 2 years to allow for extra negotiating time. It's really interesting to think about the UK government's approach to these negotiations. And, you know, since Dominic Cummings has returned to Downing Street after his illness, really one can detect that the UK government's position has doubled down on no extension in June. Part of this is down to, obviously, the concerns which some UK government ministers have in relation to the cost of any extension, you know, basically without the rebate, which went on the UK leaving the EU, you're looking at sort of 10 billion net contributions for a year's extension. Would it be drawn into some of the discussions that are going on in terms of the Eurozone Rescue Fund? Probably not, but nevertheless, they'd be making that argument in terms of the media as a reason why not to have a year's extension. So I think we can see, because of that and the sort of negotiating argument which some in Whitehall are making, which is to say that they think the longer this process goes on, but essentially running down the clock on the EU, the more likely they would be to get concessions from the EU on some of the issues we described at the start of our podcast. And whether they're right or wrong in that, that is very much the approach that they're adopting. So I think we and the European Commission and the Member States are now not expecting the UK now to propose or indeed to accept any invitation made by the EU to extend in terms of the Article 50 procedure. Nevertheless, it's becoming really clear, speaking to businesses, whether it's on questions of customs, VAT, food checks, safety and security checks, common transit convention scanning, all of these sort of controls that would come in, which we don't have at the moment on the cross-border movement of goods, that really it's doubtful, very doubtful, that companies can be ready on the 1st of January. So some kind of period of adjustment or preparation is going to be required. And we would say that this should be led by evidence. If companies need an extra 6 months to get their computer systems and their staff, their supply chains, right in terms of a new customs approach, then let's base it on those needs of business. Let's look at having, you know, a 6 or 7 month period which can allow those adjustments to be made. Now, legally, it is much more difficult to try and do this. The withdrawal agreement does allow for amendments, but not in relation to the part that talks about at the transition period. But nevertheless, it is possible to conceive of how one could devise a preparation period or adjustment period within any agreement between the EU and the UK in October, which could perform the same role as extending the transition period. So I think there's a long way to go. Business needs to make the argument on a pragmatic, evidence-based approach. But I would still express good confidence that businesses will not be put into a cliff edge of having to deal with completely new trading terms in a state of unpreparedness in January. An adjustment period, I think, is a possibility. We need to develop that, and it's something that we can fight for and would be in the interests of everyone.
Right. Well, that sounds like a bit of a mixed bag. Some things sounding slightly positive, some things possibly a little bit less. Aidan, turning to you now, it's obviously been a big week for Northern Ireland too, with the publication of the Cabinet Office Command Paper on implementing the Protocol of Ireland and Northern Ireland. So what's actually in the document that'll have an impact on retail and also on cross-Irish sea supply chains?
Well, firstly, can I say that I hope everyone who's listening to this has had buckets of coffee, because we are into the real weeds of detail here when we're talking about tariffs, etc. I almost fell asleep there when William was talking. Not that has anything to do with what it's a pretty soothing voice, William. Let's go with that. Northern Ireland, you're absolutely right. It's been a huge week, but it's been a huge week in both a positive and a negative sense. And the positive sense is that the British government has, the UK government has come out and said how that it realises that it is going to need to implement the Northern Ireland Protocol, and it's put suggestions on the table. Now, a lot of these suggestions, and this is where it's slightly disappointing, a lot of these suggestions are going to need fundamental and some small derogations from the Union's Customs Code and from different things that make up the main tenets of the single market and customs union. And we've got to remember that for the EU, this has always been existential rather than simply a trade negotiation. They need to protect that single market. They need to protect that customs union. And it's not just about Northern Ireland or the United Kingdom. It's about other people such as the Ukraine, Switzerland, Norway, who, if they see that there are derogations being given out, they will be at the front door of the EU knocking to get the same sort of derogations. Because you remember, they have had these negotiations, for example, with Switzerland over the past 40 years to get working relationships with the EU. So the eyes of the world are on what's happening with these negotiations, not just the UK government and the EU. As far as the paper itself is concerned, there's a lot of ambition, and that's good. Ambition's always good. There's not a lot of detail. And that's where we come to the big problem. We're 6.5 months out now from the end of the transition period. We had said in January that it was a Herculean task to get everything in place by the 1st of January 2021. It's only got harder since then. But again, to sort of echo William's pragmatic approach to this, all is not lost. And the fact that we have seen that progress with the British government coming out with this paper does inspire a little bit more confidence. Also, the conversations that we've been having with Task Force UK and with our European friends says that there could be a slight bit more malleability than we have seen before, a slight bit more flexibility. However, we need to be very clear about this, that the road ahead of us is not only rocky, but it's long, and that we do need to be realistic about what needs to be done. We need to get more information about these technical solutions, especially on the technical side of things when it comes to things like IT, when it comes to the new custom systems and even the new types of checks, so that we can work out, firstly, how much it's going to cost, what do we need to put in place. Secondly, that we can design up the systems that have to be able to talk to both the European and the UK computer systems, and that we can do that in a way that is still affordable. The basic tenet of this and what we've always worked on is that we need a fair deal for consumers, and that's across the UK, but especially in Northern Ireland, where we have half the discretionary income of Great British households. It doesn't matter whether it's 1% above the profit margin or 100% above the profit margin. It's a simple equation. If the new costs are higher than that profit margin, then either the product or the business model becomes unviable. And that's why we have continued to push and push. The other thing about it is, with Northern Ireland households having half of that discretionary income of Great British households, they can't afford any cost rises. What we're really talking about here isn't this macroeconomic issue, it's a microeconomic issue of households. And when it boils down to it, this is a standard of living issue for Northern Ireland households. We have been talking to, over this past day, to the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, some of the ministers from the Northern Ireland Executive in Stormont, the Republic of Ireland government, the Shadow Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, and we're continuing to have those conversations. It's great that we are having them, but we need to move from the political sphere into the sphere of experts, into the sphere of the people who will have to deliver this for companies and for households. We still need to be able to get our food and our clothing from Great Britain to Northern Ireland. That's not going to change. What will change is how much it costs to do that. So in general, we've had quite a bit of movement in the fact that there's a movement in the political stance. As far as detail, we haven't had enough, and that's where we're going to concentrate in this next few weeks.
So how do you think the documents would have gone down in Brussels and in Dublin?
I think there was quite a muted response. If you look at the papers in Dublin, specifically, they concentrated on one line out of the Taoiseach, that's the Foreign Minister and Deputy Prime Minister. His reaction, they concentrated on the line that the EU will not be happy, or it would be hard for the EU to take. What he'd actually said is that he gave it a cautious welcome, that it was moving things forward. And there is that sort of pragmatic approach, but I realise the media is always going to go for the sensationalist, and media likes a bit of friction. I think we're now coming into a wee bit more pragmatism, and it's not just the UK and the EU in that more pragmatic space. Individual states are starting to see what this could mean for their industry, for their consumers, for trade. And I think there is this sort of movement now to come together. The EU has given it a cautious welcome again, but they're welcoming the fact that there is something on the table now. And I think that they will be trying to move forward after they have done some more analysis. Now, as I said before, they're not going to be happy with everything that's in this, because it needs derogation, because it needs flexibility to deliver mitigations. What that means for us is that it's a bit of a waiting game. And we're hopefully, as far as I hear this morning, there will be a formal response to member states by Wednesday of next week. That means that we can have a formal response probably by Thursday or Friday of next week. It'll be out in public as well, as what the EU actually thinks.
In terms of business input, are there any opportunities for businesses to engage with the proposals and help shape them to any extent?
Well, we have spoken to the Secretary of State yesterday, but the big thing that we have been asking for is to sit down in the room. In fact, since October, we've been asking for the reconstitution of the Alternative Arrangements Working Group. That was a working group that was brought together under the auspices of DECSU. Do you remember them? and to look at what could be done for the Northern Ireland border, or what could be done for the sea border. We need that brought together to look at how we can make the best of these proposals, because there is going to be a lot of expertise. I think there's a job for us as well to inform Parliament. Should that be through the committees, or should that be through talking to individual MPs and informing debates about what this actually means? We need them to understand that this is not, as I said before, this is not a macroeconomic trade issue solely. This is a microeconomic household standard of living issue. So that there will be chances, but the real thing is that the amount of contact that we've had from Her Majesty's government on technical issues and on wider issues around the protocol has been not great. I'm going to say over this past since July last year, August last year, we used to have meetings every couple of weeks with the Border Delivery Group. We're not having that at the minute. We haven't had anything from BAES or from the Department of International Trade, really. We haven't had those sit-down meetings or video calls as we have to do now. And I think there is a real need for that to get, that communication needs to get very enhanced, and it needs to get better very, very quickly. Quite simply, we need to use it to share our expertise. We also need to vent, and we also need to tell them what our concerns are and ask them the questions of how they're going to deliver what they've said. So yeah, this is broadly positive, since you know we got more, a little bit more detail yesterday. But there's still a lot of grunt work to be done, and that needs to start with a discussion, and that needs to start with a technical understanding of what is being proposed. That needs to happen now.
Brilliant. That sounds like a great time to leave the discussion for now. Sounds like the key message is that time is running short, just over 6 months now until all of this could become a reality for all of us and for UK retailers. So I'd like to thank both of you guys for the discussion. Thank you very much, William.
Thank you. Goodbye from me.
And cheers. Thanks to you, Aidan, as well.
And it's goodbye from him.
Brilliant. Cheers, guys. Thank you very much. And till next time, goodbye.